Hi again, this is Bob Brundage, and today is August the 6th, 2008, and today I'm chatting with a gentleman back in South Carolina, and looking forward to some interesting news about CallerLab, in that Tim Mariner was recently retired as chairman of the CallerLab. So Tim, why don't you tell us a little bit about life before square dancing and so forth.
Well, let's see. I was born in Maine, up around Waterville area, near Augusta, and was relocated with my parents down to Norfolk, Virginia, where they started square dancing. And after several years of watching it, they enticed me to get involved, and I reluctantly went into the door and dragged my feet and went ahead and started the dance process. About halfway through lessons, the caller there that was teaching, his name was Charlie Pergrassi, he invited me to do some amateur work for an upcoming dance that they were having, and provided me with several records to try to memorize, and so I started that process and was doing singing calls fairly on a regular basis. And about halfway through my lessons, he started training me on doing the patter part of the calling. And I was trained with him sort of as his mentor for several years there in the Norfolk area. And before long, I was doing party dances and different groups and helping folks with assisting their classes, and somebody got shipped out from the area, and an opening came up, and I started calling for a club on a regular basis. That was back in about 1975.
Okay.
So, and then ever since then, I've been still calling all my way up through schooling. I was 13 when I started all of this.
Oh, yes. All right. That's about the same age that I started.
How about that?
But that was 1933.
All right.
I noticed in your bio that when you were in school, you were a member of a jazz choir. I'm not quite sure what that is.
Well, the university that I was a part of was Old Dominion University. They had a group that was forming that was going to be pretty much helping for public relations for the university, and it was a jazz quartet made up of somewhere around 20 folks, 25 people.
Uh-huh.
And what we did was we just performed different types of numbers, a lot of various things, show and song and dance type of routines, we traveled around the state to help kind of promote the university.
There you go.
And I really didn't get much formal training in singing, along up that through that time. I sang in church choirs up to about that point, and that's about all the training I've had. And so at that point, I was kind of learning as others were performing around me, and enjoyed it very much, and continued on with that through my final year after I got my degree and graduated. So I have some, I guess the training that I have right now is basically from that group and from those groups.
Oh, that's great. Yeah, was yours a musical family?
My parents both were musically inclined. Mother played the piano, father played the harmonica and trombone, and there was always a guitar around and those sorts of things. And I tried my hand at doing the piano a little bit and a little bit of guitar and a little banjo here and there.
Uh-huh.
But never really took a hold of any of those things because I was more involved in the singing and then doing the square dance calling. So
right.
I just followed up doing that.
Yes. Okay. Well, while you're getting into, or I should say, when did you get introduced to square dancing, It was through your parents, obviously.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Yep. Through their home club there in the area.
In Norfolk.
In Norfolk, Virginia.
Okay. Well, along your way, who were some of your mentors?
Oh, I've had a lot of them along the way. Right there in that Norfolk region, there was a lot of very talented callers that were coming in and out. And at the time, there was Ken Beck was in the area. He was a well-known caller in that region that did some traveling. And then there was Al Stevens that came through and had a stint in the Newport News, Virginia Beach area as well. And then there was the callers that were just there, the area callers that sort of helped me along as I was a member of their callers association.
Oh, yes. You want to mention some of those? I'm trying to think of...
Well, let's see. There would be Sid Arnold was there. In that time frame, Bob Worley was in that region too for that time frame, and then there was Gene Shun. There was a lot of them. I can't think of all of the names, but
yeah.
there were several there, and they had some very good clubs. They had some one group had a youth group and an adult group, as many of them did. And the group that I was with, it was still a family-orientated club. We had a lot of teenagers involved, and some of them were cloggers and were doing other things at the same time. We were square dancing. So,
one reason I was curious a little bit, because I did a weekend at the Golden Triangle in Norfolk.
That's right.
Don't tell me you were there.
That was the Azalea Festival.
Well, yeah, I did a weekend there with Chuck Donahue.
Yep. I remember Chuck coming through the area and yourself. And, there were so many others that came through.
Yeah.
There was a lot of clubs in that area. There was, I know Cal Golden used to come through there, Ed Foote, Jack Lazary. Of course, there were just so many folks that had the opportunity to come in. There was a lot of clubs.
Yeah.
And there were 20 square groups back in those days.
Yes, right. Well, I was scheduled to do a weekend the following year with Marshall Flippo, but that somehow got canceled. How about caller schools? I know you're involved in one right now.
Well, I'm part of the Rocky Mountain Caller School, which is a group right now where we're based out of Durango, Colorado, with Ron Marcus.
Uh-huh.
And we're right now in the process of possibly moving that up to Denver and trying to get a better central location where people could get in and out of with an airport.
Yes.
But what we're finding is it's difficult right now to, I know we're having downsized some dancers. We're having the same problem with callers.
Yes.
So that school's going on. But I've been a part of others. We'd started a South Carolina school, Tony Oxendine and myself did, and had it going quite well in South Carolina. Then it moved up to Charlotte, and it was the Carolina Caller School. And but I was a part of years ago. I attended the caller school that right now Randy Page is currently operating with Mike Jacobs.
Uh-huh.
And that was with your brother Al.
Okay.
And Clint McLean, Earl Johnston, and Jack Lazary.
Oh, that was quite a staff.
That was a great staff. It was, there's three of us in the area that said, well, let's go, we'll get a room together and split the expenses, and so we did that. That was in the late 70s, I believe was 79 or something along that line that we attended that school.
Right.
And, boy, was it great. I was an eye-opener because there was about 50 callers there. And, of course, we were the young, runny-nosed ones that were sitting on the sideline probably not paying as much attention as necessary.
Yes.
But we had the tape recorders going and recorded every bit of it, and ever since then, I've gone back and listened to those tapes periodically, and it's amazing the amount of material that was presented.
I'll bet.
Terrific.
Right. So I noticed you've done a lot of traveling overseas as well.
Well, I've been very fortunate to have the opportunity to do that. I guess we started off all era regionally wise, and then somebody from out of the state kind of contacts you because they were somewhere to hear you, and then it sort of ripples around and wound up where I was called to do some dances in Japan. And so I started traveling back into Japan, where I've made now 25 different trips over to Japan.
Wow.
And many trips into Europe and a couple of trips down to Australia and back. Of course, all across the states here in Canada, we did some cruises and several resorts. It's been fortunate to be able to do that. I enjoy the opportunity. It's the expenses are a little steep now with the airlines and the fees going up and some of the downsizing of the activities, but
sure.
It's still a treat to be able to do that.
Right. How about festivals and national conventions and so forth?
Well, I've attended a lot of the national conventions, and back in those days, starting out about 79 when it was in Atlantic City, I believe, somewhere up in that region. It might could have been 77 the year, I don't have, but
yes.
After that point in time, I was making just about every one of those, and more music was not present there, and so I pretty much asked them if they would have a problem with me doing other things, and they thought not, and so I ventured off, and I had a probably a year there where I wasn't doing anything, and so then I get a phone call from Elmer to record with ESP Records.
Uh-huh.
And that's who I'm currently recording with at this time, and have enjoyed it because in the short few months that I've been with them, I've had the opportunity of already recording four different tunes, and they've been all selling for them. So it's good. I enjoy it. I enjoy being able to put the vocals and coming up creatively wise with the choreography. And,
right. And, have you done any writing per se outside of what you did as chairman of the Caller Lab?
Well, other than years ago, I used to write square dance material.
Okay.
I had a couple of calls that I had published with Bill Davis and others and Jack Lazary. One of them was a quarterly selection, but it didn't take after the quarterly selection process sort of fizzled out, and the call went up through, I think, it's probably sitting on a C4 list somewhere called Lock the Top.
Okay.
But, you know, those sorts of things. And I had some articles that I did for the magazine here and occasion there, and that was about it. As chairman, though, you have more exposure to write more.
Yes.
So I've had the opportunity to do more articles and get some things published that way.
Right. Well, I think that leads us into the main reason that I wanted to talk to you today, and that is Caller Lab itself.
Mm-hmm.
I know you've just recently retired as chairman.
That's right.
And perhaps you can tell us, well, when did you first get on the board of directors?
I was on the board of governors there for 3 years back in the mid-90s.
Uh-huh.
Early to mid-90s. And Ernie Kinney, I believe, was chairman at the time there. And we had, we're phasing in from John Kay to George White, and we were having the board work there, and I did some work with the to get the foundation established for Caller Lab.
Yes.
And then I took a couple of years and got off the board for a while, and then later on decided, well, let me go back to work again. So I carried back on and have been on the board ever since. I was elected to the executive committee, and now I'm sitting on probably the 8th year of being a part of that.
Yes.
And in that time frame, I sort of watched others work as chairman and said, well, that's not going to be too bad a shift to go from a vice chairman to chairman, so let me go ahead and do it.
Yes.
And did that, and I enjoyed the work. It was it took a lot of time because you have the amount of email today and the amount of correspondence and the commitment of having to attend the different conventions, the round of labs, the different reciprocal groups, arts was being formed, and it takes a lot of time. I'm glad that I was able to do it. I've learned a lot. I mean, in that process while I was on the board, worked my way as a collar coach, an accredited collar coach.
Yes.
And I thoroughly enjoy teaching. As I have a home group still that I teach, and I enjoy mentoring other callers, and that whole process is something that I'll probably always do. Now that I'm not chairman, I have more free time to take a look at those types of things, to be able to work on helping different schools and organizing different things. So that's sort of what I'm looking for the future with that.
Right. What's the how many callers are on the Board of Governors?
We have a 25-member board.
Yes. And the Executive Committee?
We have 5 for the Executive Committee.
Yes.
And out of the Executive Committee, of course, then you have the Vice Chairman and the Chairman.
Yes. And I guess once you're on a committee or on the board or the executive committee, I guess you serve as long as you're elected, right?
Well, that's correct. You can. You have a 3-year term that you're voted in.
Yes.
And as soon as you get your feet wet, you have to go back, it seems like, and petition to get back on the board every 3 years. I think that's a good thing because, you know, you still want the membership support. That's why you're there, trying to represent what the members want.
Right.
At the same time, trying to be assured that the work is getting done from convention to convention. We used to have committees that only operated at convention time.
Yes.
But with the advent of email and being able to communicate faster, these committees are getting more work done now than ever, and so the process is getting sped up. They're doing more output. Of course, the home office is having to pick up that load a lot too. So,
sure.
Kudos to them. They've done a great job of maintaining things,
right,
keeping up with the increased work that's going on with the committees.
Right. Well, I know there's a myriad of committees actually. You probably served on some yourself, actually.
Well, I did. I was a part of the different program committees from mainstream all the way up to advanced and challenge.
Uh-huh.
Because that was where I was working the most. And then I later got involved with the collar coaching committees and some of the education committees.
Yes.
But I think I still have a passion with the program committees. There's a lot of work that still needs to be done with fixing up the definitions, clarifying the definitions, and then having a comfortable teach order that can be more concise, where we can get dancers efficiently educated in a more proficient manner.
Right. Well, what's your take on the way various basics are shifting from mainstream to plus or plus to mainstream and so forth?
You know, I'd like to see a balance of all the programs.
Yes.
I'd like to see where there'd be maybe a 30-35 basic and a 30-35 mainstream. Right now we have a 51 basic and a 17 or 15 or so mainstream calls. I think it's 17 mainstream calls. And that's an imbalance. And what happens is when people teach, and if they apply the teaching to the order that we have currently, what happens is they teach the mainstream at the very end, which are the more difficult calls, and the dancers have very little floor time to become proficient at it.
Yes.
And so what I find is that if you integrate the mainstream calls with the basic calls early enough, if that's the destination is mainstream, teach a few of those calls that have flow or that have danceability that are similar to actions at basics. For example, after you separate and go around one or two and come down the middle, it's very easy to teach cloverleaf.
Yes.
And it's similar in action, and so the dancers can positively influenced on how to do that call. And so it's not difficult, but when you put it to the end and you're not relating it to some basic, there's a bridge and it's a level of difficulty that increase. Plus, they're getting a little floor time at the end. You know, there might be learning spin the top and recycle in Dixie styles all at the end of their lessons, and they have 5 weeks to do it.
Yes.
And then they finish, and they fumble over those calls because they haven't had the floor time,
right,
and the frequency of call rate to be able to dance those calls proficiently. So putting them in earlier, running Dixie style early, I find that you can, they will become proficient dancers, and they'll be more confident dancers when they finish. And the bridge between the class, the new dancers, and the club atmosphere is reduced, and the club dancers are willing to accept the newer dancers because they're more proficient. They're able to kind of keep up like they used to. And so they're less standoffish, the club members are, or they don't frown whenever they break down as much because they're not breaking down as much.
Yes, yeah.
So that's sort of the idea of what I'd like to see the teach order be revised to and be more balanced. It's slowly happening in increments.
Yes.
We went and decided in the year 2000 that we wanted change. And there was folks that were trying to make big change happen all at once. But I find that the membership likes little change, and they're willing to chew on changes, small bits of changes in increments.
Yes.
And you can accomplish more by doing things incrementally than
yes.
trying to have everybody swallow this big, huge difference that they want to have done. So, okay, the basic program's been reintroduced. Now we just need to balance it with the mainstream program, and it would be great to have 33 calls or so at basic, 30-some-odd calls at mainstream, and then look, we have 33 calls at plus, we've got about 33 calls at A1 and 33-5 or so at A2, and what happens to challenge is going to stay in challenge and it won't change. So it's fairly balanced if we can get it that way at the beginning, and I think we're starting to see it steer in that direction, although it's been slow. Will it bring more dancers on the dance floor? Is a good question. I think that probably it's going to take a lot of recruitment efforts to make changes in our numbers. We have to have more proficient teachers and educators to maintain those numbers too. So that's something that's got to be answered later too.
Right. Well, that's an interesting concept. And I noticed on the discussion groups, there's quite a bit of talk today about changing the name of Trade By. Any thoughts on that?
Trade By. I haven't heard that one. Now, didn't they just do that with Barge Through? I mean,
yeah. Well, that's part of it, I think. Yeah. And someone said that they used to call it Pass and Trade.
Wow, I don't know.
Yeah,
I haven't heard that one, so that's pretty interesting.
Yeah, right. Well,
there's quite a few calls that we have that are questionable as far as the programs go.
Yes.
And okay, we have, for example, Do-Si-Do, and we have Do-Si-Do to a wave.
Yes.
But we have step to a wave, so why couldn't we just say Do-Si-Do and step to a wave?
Right.
And so there's some redundancies that I think could be cleaned up that would reduce some of our teaching.
Yeah. Well, okay, well, I noticed that Coralab also has several awards that, you know, they like the 25-year award.
Mm-hmm.
And what are some of the others?
Well, we have a we have the 25-year award, quarter century, and then we have the century award for 50 years. There was one millennium award that was awarded to the late Bob Osgood.
Yes.
And then we have the gold card membership.
Right.
And the of course the milestone awards.
Yes. The gold card. Are you presenting that to anybody new? Or it was fairly stagnant there for a while.
A lot of these awards we look at as an executive committee.
Yes.
And we try not to make it a situation where every year there's going to be one. There's a lot of people that are deserving of a lot of awards, and we could be dishing out awards and have our evening dinners go on indefinitely because there's just a lot of great people working.
Right.
But to make it and to keep those awards special, I think we've taken a little more diligence at narrowing out and making sure that the ones who are qualified are deserving, and also as good is not the right word, but as
deserving
as the ones who already have it. That's a great word.
Right. Well, I noticed you also have scholarships available, and
that's correct. Through the foundation, mostly we have some through the Coralab organization. We have a George White scholarship. We had a Jerry Schatzer scholarship, but most of the funds have dwindled in some of those.
Yes.
There's several scholarships that are available, mostly for education purposes. So folks can apply those for those to get these grants, if you will, to attend different matriculated or Coralab curriculum schools.
Uh-huh.
And it helps. $250 here and or somewhat helps for these folks to be able to attend some of these schools.
Right.
We also did a grant. We gave some money to an organization in Sweden who needed money to start a radio program that was going to be utilized on, say, every Monday. They were going to have a big interview and a dance that was going to be put on public radio.
Yes.
And so we got startup money started for that program to get going, and it did very well for them over there. So we've also utilized funds for different surveys and those sorts of things to kind of keep the feel of the pulse of what the activity is and where we're headed.
Right. And another ambitious project you've taken on 2 years ago are the mini labs.
That's right. Those mini labs were put in place because we felt at one time it was too difficult to be able to attend a Coralab convention. And so the membership regulations and rules have sort of been modified and changed to make it somewhat easier to be able to attend, but still it's relatively expensive to be able to do so, even if you're overseas, but more so if you're overseas.
Right.
And so the mini labs were set up to be able to have a program very similar to Cololab Convention, but on a smaller scale, but more so if you're overseas.
Right.
And so the mini labs were set up to be able to have a program very similar to Cololab Convention, but on a smaller scale operated in those countries. And so we had one in Germany, and we've had them in Canada. We just finished one in Canada. We've now had three in Australia. I just came back from one from Australia. And New England had one many years ago. And so we found that by having these conventions and mini labs at these different areas, we are able to communicate directly to the region and say, this is what we do, this is what we offer as an organization.
Yes.
And our members have increased. I think way back in the, the late 90s or so, there was a fallout of some of our foreign memberships. They weren't involved. They weren't actively involved.
Yes.
And so we had a lot of communication just within the states. And so we started making changes to our programs without a lot of heed to what reaction would take place overseas. Subsequently, it was the thing that woke the lion. They woke up and said, hey, why are you making these changes? And, you know, we like this the way it was, and now you've changed it. Why did you change it? Well, if you were a member of the committees, you would have been in the process. So we've increased now our awareness overseas and have a overseas advisory committee, and membership is easier in different committees. They can just get their email and vote. If they don't, it's still mailed to them in a timely manner that they can still get a vote back. And they have a bigger voice than before now because of that.
Yes.
At least we have a worldly view of what the programs should and how they should be maintained. And I think that's a fair balance.
Yes.
Otherwise, it would just be totally all of just American square dancing.
Right.
Which is what we have, but it's still, we like to have it be modern and up-to-date and more of a world-class activity that is going to be achievable and obtainable in all countries across the world.
Right. When you're calling overseas, any of these countries, do you find they're experiencing the same thing that we had, we always refer to as the rush to plus?
Not quite so much, Bob. I think that's because they, one, have to take the time to learn the language, not just the language of square dancing, but they have to learn some of the English innuendos and move on to the next, and those sorts of types of calls that are still being used that aren't on the programs anywhere.
Right.
And so they have to learn English terms. In that process, I think they take a stronger approach at learning the fundamentals.
Yes.
They'll have some that will be in the basic program for a year, and then they'll learn mainstream later.
Yes.
But they're integrated in the clubs immediately.
Right.
And I think that's something that here in the U.S. we really ought to take heed to. Rather than keeping them at a distance away from us on a different night and keeping them 30 weeks to a year off on their own and then try to incorporate them in our club.
Yes.
We should be trying to have the class, the new dancers, involved with the club activity immediately. And then the transition between the new dancers and the club is lessened. They're friends immediately. There's a bond. There's a glue that keeps everybody together. Unfortunately, I think we all probably focus too much on the puzzle and not enough on the social.
Yes.
And what happens is, at that point in time, we've created puzzle goers and puzzle movers and puzzle resolvers on the floor rather than create a social network where they're going to be maintained and enjoy the fellowship of what we have to offer.
Right.
And I think if groups are having those types of problems, then they need to start looking at what they offer socially.
Right.
We used to always go and do our dances and go out to somebody's house and sit around, or we'd do things other than square dancing on weekends, and be camp out groups, or we might square dance, we might not.
Yeah, well, there are always after parties.
Sure, the after parties. You just hang out and someone would play a guitar or tell stories, and there's the social glue, and I think we have it in today's dance, but it's limited.
Yes.
People go to the dances, they attend, and they leave, and you don't know somebody personally at all.
Yes, that's true.
That's a problem.
Yeah.
And we have that in our own society, too, because there's a lot of folks who have no idea who their neighbors are.
Oh, sure. That's true. What about the musical aspects of it? I mean, I get the impression that you don't really teach people to really dance.
Well, that's a thing that the activity has when you're working puzzles so much.
Yes.
The dancers go here, stop, wait, and go over there, stop, and wait.
Yeah.
And the advent of flowing from one call to the next is lost. And so I think it's still important to be able to instill what dancing is. And I like the wind in my face type dancing where it goes continuously from one call to the next, and you get back to home and you can breathe and go, wow, you know, we did that.
Right.
And everybody celebrates because they got there. It's like, oh, that was super. How did we get back? And so that the flow of the dance, I think, is important, not just at basic and mainstream, but through all the programs. I've seen advanced and challenge groups where they're playing the music still at 135 beats a minute, but the dancers just hurry up and go over there and wait.
Yes.
After every call.
Yes.
That's not enjoyable to me at all.
Right.
And I don't know, you know, how much puzzle you use. If it flows from one call to the next, something you didn't anticipate, and you get on and move to the next call, to me that's what I enjoy, and then it, you know, you come up with some sort of resolve where it's interesting, and you get back home and you go, oh, that was great.
Right. Well, we're about to the end of this side of the tape.
Sure.
Still a little bit of time, but I want to, is there anything else about Caller Lab you want to tell us about before I switch to some other questions?
Sure. You know, it's an organization I wish more people would get involved with. We have people today that are a little apathetic. They're very set in their ways. They're very content with the way things are right now. They might not be buying or purchasing any new music. They might not be involved with any of the committees. They might not even get their license through Caller Lab. They might get it on their own or through another organization. But I think, as much as we get out of it, we need to put something back into the activity.
Okay.
Caller Lab is an organization where they can do that. They can get back and roll up their sleeves a little bit and help out with different committee works, some expertise or something that they have of some interest. We have women in calling committees and all the different program committees, but we have recruitment committees and new initiative committees and those types of things that if they really wanted to get involved, they could, and they would be amazed at how it recharges and energizes their batteries when they come back from some convention.
Right.
They've done this work. Sure, there's times where things change slowly, but sometimes that's a good thing. We don't need to be so radical in that approach to change things totally. I think we're at crossroads, and we do have a modern activity that needs to breathe and needs to have some changes, but we can adapt. And I think Call Lab's always been an organization there for the betterment of the activity, and would encourage anyone who's not involved to get involved just to see what it's about and to energize themselves so that they can be motivators and leaders in their own clubs again.
Right. Okay, well, let me take a minute and turn this tape over, and I'll get back to you in just a second. Hold on.
Okay, Bob.
Okay, so we've turned the tape over and we're ready to continue along. We were just talking about the musical aspects of dancing, which brings up the point, do you do any contras?
I do some simple contras. I do a lot more party dances than I think the average caller does, and I enjoy them. I still enjoy them, and they're of all ages. I'll take the youth and right up through to the adult groups and introduce different types of folk dancing to the group, not necessarily always square dancing, but in that process I do some simple contras and some reels, and I'll do the big circle dancers, mixers, a few easy rounds, and line dances, country western two-step things that will get a group off the floor and on the floor rather and moving around. And I have something on my website that's interesting. It's like I say, DJs play music, but we offer an experience or on the floor experience to be able to get up and to get the people active. And it's not a participating, it's not a spectator sport. It's a participating sport. You have
right.
to get involved where you really enjoy it. And
right.
So I have the opportunity to still do some dance parties, and I enjoy those. I know that people used to call them the one-night stands and those sorts of things, and they are having trouble trying to figure out a better term, so they call them party nights or one-nighters, party nights, and I like to call them dance parties because that's what we do. We provide different types of dances at this party that we're involved with.
Right. Looking back at your long career, do you have any regrets?
Oh, I didn't start sooner?
That's a thought.
Yeah. I not really. I can't say that I have. I've enjoyed things the way they've been going. I've had 35 years of being able to help out and to learn and go. I'm always learning. Every time I attend a caller school to even help work one, I learn from the material and the information that others are seeing it in a fresh approach. So I'm always learning and will continue to learn. I wish I had an opportunity to meet and to be able to be more involved with some of the we call legends of our activity before they had passed on. I would love to have been able to tap in their mindset and understand the way they thought about some of the things, and that's the only regret I would have.
Yes. Well, of course, that's one of the reasons that I started this project in the first place.
Absolutely. I think it's a great thing you're doing.
Well, thank you. And we're up to over 100 now that I've interviewed. When I first started out, I decided to try to interview all the Living Hall of Fame, Milestone, and Silver Halo people, which I was able to do.
That's great.
Of course, a few of them have passed since then.
Mm-hmm.
But what's your take on this ABC type of program?
Well, I think any type of program of teaching, any type of getting the dancers to become more proficient in a timely manner is going to be successful. If it's ABC, ZDF, any alphabet thing that comes up, it doesn't matter. If it's blast, if it's fast track, if it's the traditional method or multi-cycle, if it's bringing people together and they're learning our activity and they're able to do it and are maintained and and are consistent, I think it's a good thing. Now, ABC has had a try. I like the way they approach the idea of having three groupings and then moving on. It was very similar to some of the community dance program work that we had earlier, even.
Yes.
That didn't take. And there's a lot of reasons and speculations as to why that was. But I think what we have is anything will go and will work, but what happens is if you had it in a vacuum and you were able to teach dancers whatever it was you wanted, it would probably work for you.
Yes.
But in today's dance world, we have groups that are members of the standard traditional club atmosphere, and they're going out and they'll say, oh, well, you've learned that. That's terrific. Now you ought to learn the rest of it. Come with us. And they start cherry-picking out of those groups.
Yes.
And now that group is going to disintegrate. It's just inevitable.
Yes.
So if we had a shortened basic program and somebody were to be able to successfully make that go here in the States, people would mimic that or model that.
Yes.
Maybe that would be a program or something that would run parallel to what we have now and then maybe eventually segue back to what we have in our modern groups. I think there's some evolution that still has to take place. I think we have call redundancies. Personally, I think we have a bit of calls that are archaic that probably aren't providing as much dance action as necessary. And now, granted, I like the traditional type of dances too, but I think there's a point in time where if it's hindering our groups, then it's probably not necessary. And there are some movements that we have in our programs that are relatively, you have to be ambidextrous to be able to perform them. You've got to reach over your shoulders and twirl around and those sorts of things. And with the aging of our group, maybe those are types of calls that aren't quite as necessary today as it used to be. I can go on a long time. It's a fascinating subject.
Yes.
But I think if we can have a shortened teach time and still allow the dancers to enjoy that dancing experience and the social side of what we have,
right.
I think they'll be able to recruit and maintain good numbers. I'm having satisfactory results in my region that I'm teaching, and I think other people can too if they were to mimic it.
Right. Well, then that poses a question of where do you think square dancing will end up, or where do you think it's going?
Well, I think it's still on a downsizing trend right now, and I see it that way because of the aging of our activity. We have an upper enchilance of callers, if you will, that enchilance of callers is getting pretty old, and not that they aren't effective, but the idea that in, you know, realistically 10 years, where are we going to be? We'll have lost some of those great members.
Yes.
And I think we have a gap of bringing in newer or younger dancers. And so, unfortunately, when I started 35 years ago, I was one of the younger callers in the activity. And 35 years later, I still am. I mean,
yes.
We've got a problem.
Yes.
We've got over three decades, if not four, where we've neglected to recruit and maintain a younger group of dancers to be able to continue the activity in the long run.
Yes.
We sort of got this wave. We're riding the crest. Well, that wave has already hit the shore. Now we're looking back trying to see where's the wave again.
Right.
Right now we don't seem to have one, and that bothers me. There are a couple of areas where they are recruiting younger people, and there are a few folks that are having some good results, but not the big wave that we had in the early the 60s and 70s, where we had just, you know, younger groups,
right,
and family groups. We don't seem to have that today quite as much. So I think the trend is still, there's going to be some downsizing until we can find the niche or whatever it's going to take to make this interesting and appealing to a younger public. That right now we've got so much competition with the internet and movies and other entertainment values that they're seeking, other than square dancing.
Right.
And I think we have a society, unfortunately, that's cocooning themselves in their homes. They're not coming out and worried about neighbors and learning or having much social activity at all.
Right.
With the exception of maybe now they're learning that they can talk to people on the internet, and where's that getting them?
Right.
A lot of them in trouble.
Yeah. So. You think there's any possibility of big corporation sponsorship?
I don't see the need yet for corporations to take that on. We don't have the... I'd love to think that we had a product that would be appealing, that they would like to be a part of.
Yes.
But I think right now we don't have the numbers there to be able to do that. It would be great if we could find something or a group that would take that on and be able to be a sponsor for the activity. But most of them right now don't need the fewer numbers that we have and the demographics of who we are.
Yes. Do you think competition is part of it?
Competition in which field? In
if square dancing. There are, you know, there up in the northwest corner of the country, there's that teenage competition thing.
I think that's a hoot. I think that's an interesting twist that is actually helping. The competitive groups that we have in some of that northwest, and there's also groups in Pennsylvania and a few in other areas where they're having this 4-H or farm show type competitive groups.
Yes.
Dancing. And what it's doing is it's shedding the light of the misconceptions that people have about the activity.
Right.
These stereotypes are falling down because we've got some great leaders in those regions that are taking modern music, taking suitable choreography, and applying it to the younger groups.
Yes.
And they're having a ball doing it.
Right.
So now whether they'll stay with the activity, maybe, maybe not, but somewhere down the line, if somebody talks about square dancing, they're going to have, because they've had positive meaning and results, they're gonna think positive about the activity, and maybe we'll join again.
Right.
So I think that they're laying good roots in those regions. I'd like to see it spread.
Right. Well, I did a thing with the 4-H and the Future Farmers of America and so forth back in New York State many years ago, and it went on for quite a while. And I thought it was a very, very advantageous program. I thought it was a lot of enthusiasm, and
sure does. And what it does is the younger market or the younger groups that are involved, you'll find and they're finding already that there are younger people interested in taking up the activity for calling wise.
Right.
And of course that's the magnet that needs that attraction of bringing in more younger people.
Right.
To be able to have those.
Yes. Well, golly, this has really been an interesting conversation with you today, Jim. And
Bob, I appreciate the opportunity. I hope you have good luck with future folks and getting the interviews going. And it's been fun talking with you.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time, and I'll let you get back in your backyard and enjoy the rest of the day. So, well, why don't we wrap it up then, and I'll shut the tape off, and I'll look forward to seeing you sometime in the future.
It's been an honor. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you, Tim.